Paul McCartney in the news again, writing to President Putin about the Greenpeace people now under arrest. Paul takes planes. There was a jet engine in that song. But should you, if you're green, should Charles? Here's Brendan May in London with a firm opinion.
A few years ago, Prince Charles found himself in all sorts of trouble for accepting an environment award overseas. But he flew, they cried. Since then, from what I can tell, he's had to resort largely to pre-recorded video or even appearing as a hologram at non-British environmental summits. Luckily, he adds as much green work onto his official state visits as he can. Having seen firsthand what the Prince's interventions can do to get a green cause moving, I was so annoyed by the fuss that I wrote a letter to one of the newspapers who'd covered the story. I argued that since the Prince had spent his entire adult life campaigning for sustainability, he wasn't simply entitled to fly anywhere he liked in support of that cause, but actually he should do in order to build the kind of global traction needed for his many responsible business causes. After all, we wouldn't say Mother Teresa shouldn't have flown anywhere because the poor she represented couldn't afford a plane ticket, would we? In general, I think people who spend all their waking hours trying to change business to stop them wrecking the planet aren't just allowed to travel, but have an obligation to do so. You won't stop deforestation in the tropics from a meeting room in the English West Country, where, for some reason I've never understood, a lot of this don't go anywhere except by monocycle mantra seems to reside. Having spent a large part of my working life dealing with fisheries, forestry, and agricultural commodities issues, it's very clear to me that I'd have been able to do almost none of it without flying. And without a single exception, all of the people I know who've done great things in the environmental field have travelled far and wide. We don't do it for fun. It takes us away from our families, and mostly we see airports and hotel rooms that all look the same. It's actually exhausting and it's possibly life-shortening, but we do it because we'd achieve far less without it. So that's my defence of Greens getting on planes, but I actually want to go further. I wish more environmentalists would get on planes as often as possible. In Britain, we see ourselves as a global hub of green innovation, the best thinking, the proud host of some of the world's most sustainable companies, and so on. And yes, we have some good retailers and some great responsible business institutions. But having spent more and more time in the developing world, particularly in Indonesia, my perspective on a lot of things has changed. I don't think much of the well-meaning green fraternity in England has ever seen the size and scale of the problems that are coming down the track. They've seen pictures and slogans and read reports and articles, but they haven't seen firsthand the changes that are looming in these emerging giants. Where I live, it's fashionable to sit in yurts talking about green brand revolutions and consumer behaviour change. It all sounds marvellous, doesn't it? But I fear a lot of it is cloud cuckoo land. It's a reflection of how its proponents would like to live. But it bears no resemblance whatever to the reality of the vast rising middle classes of India, China and Indonesia, to name but three. Earlier this year, I listened to a campaigner pontificating about governance issues in a particular country, how terrible its companies were and so on. It was only at the end of the meeting that it emerged that the individual had not once set foot in the country on which they were apparently such an expert. From then on, I found it hard to take what was being said too seriously. I'm writing this script on a flight from London to Singapore on my way to Jakarta. It's the fifth time this year I've done this 24-hour journey. When I arrive, tired after midnight, miles away from my wife and baby, in the wrong time zone, I'll survey the view from my hotel window. I'll see traffic jams, vast new construction schemes, the logos of every Western brand you've heard of, adorning the towers and the malls. I'll hear endless horns blasting and diggers churning up the tarmac. In the morning, it'll be hard to get a table for breakfast, as my hotel will be full of people who've come here to trade their goods, or in my case, work on sustainability issues with NGOs and companies. Lunch may take place in one of Jakarta's huge malls, where for some shoppers, one iPhone isn't enough. They have two, one for work, the other for pleasure. That's the rich side of Jakarta. Elsewhere, there's poverty, terrible poverty, exacerbated by poor land rights, weak governance, and past corporate misdeeds. Next week, three of my colleagues, all well-known environmentalists, will make the same trip, but they'll visit the jungles of Sumatra as well. They'll see the threat to communities and wildlife posed by political and corporate recklessness, and also the solutions and the positive progress being made. All of this travel is to help shape and articulate one of the most significant business transformations in recent history. So I would argue it's worth it. When I return to England, I'll catch up with emails and tweets that will include invitations to webinars and summits about how mobile phone companies are changing the world, why I should only shop at farmers' markets, and how I can power my burglar alarm using cucumber pulp and worm poo. Well, not quite, but you know what I mean. Given the sensory overload I'll have just had, dealing with challenges of such magnitude it's sometimes hard to find answers, this will all to me feel like very provincial and largely irrelevant twaddle. I know it isn't entirely, but in my view this represents an unambitious and largely fruitless mindset when it comes to global environmental issues. What countries like Britain and Australia do matters abroad to some degree, in climate diplomacy, for example. But an awful lot of what goes on strikes me as a huge waste of resources. I suspect about 75 pence of every British pound spent on green initiatives, roundtables, conferences, rankings, publications and reports in the UK could more usefully be spent grappling with the emerging giant economy's challenges from a political and corporate perspective. Britain's environmental footprint is minuscule in comparison, and it'll become ever more so in relative terms as growth continues in emerging economies. When I think of localism, another favourite buzzword of the Green movement, I don't think about a county or a parish. I think about Britain as a whole, which is viewed in Asia and elsewhere as a small, albeit significant, part of the European Union. Without that union, it would be nothing at all. The way we bang on about green issues at home, you'd think we were a global sustainability powerhouse, a beacon to the world. We simply aren't. The green movement, where I come from, lacks global perspective. All our debates about high-speed rail, airport expansion, fracking and so on feel incredibly significant when you're in London. But when you're in Asia or the United States, they seem barely peripheral. If you don't believe me, get on a plane, or at least let the Prince of Wales get on a plane. If those with the power and the skills to change the world don't travel round it with a sense of urgency, there'll be very little left to talk about in that yurt. The big challenges are in the oceans, the tropical rainforests, and the cocoa plantations of distant lands.
Brendan May is head of the Roberts Bridge Group advising corporations on sustainability. This is The Science Show on RN.